Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Hoo-wah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciate you joining us this fine day in America. We are proud Americans. Well, here's what we have for you this hour. We're going to start by talking with Chuck Dienerstein about science, real science. Then we'll talk with Vietnam vet Ron Corser. And, of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our self-defense report. So it's a pleasure to introduce Chuck Dienerstein from the American Council on Science and Health. Chuck, tell us about what the American Council on Science and Health does and your role there.
Okay, well, I am currently the medical director at the American Council on Science and Health, which is kind of a little bit of a nebulous title, but I basically write about health and I write about science. The organization was set up back in the 70s by Dr. Elizabeth Whalen with the purpose of debunking bad scientific reporting, bad scientific findings. And we've continued that mission for 40 plus years.
Eternity, I think, in your future.
Yeah. So we spent a lot of time, or I spent a lot of time writing on aspects of health. We've all spent a lot of time over the last 3 years talking about COVID, of course, and the changing perspectives on that. But we try to cover a fair range of topics. And more specifically, I think for your audience, I wrote a piece back in the summer about the burn pits and some of the health issues that were associated with that. And interesting for me, because I am not a military person at all, there was a lot of science that indicated that a lot of the respiratory problems were related to dust in addition to the fire pits. But that's another story for another day.
Well, it is another story, but it's an example of how people take something with a bit of science that they gathered following science, and then they generalize it and ignore, don't keep filling. Science, my understanding, is never ending. If you and I were both scientists in whatever field, and you came up with something, I'd congratulate you, and I'd start picking it apart, wouldn't I?
Exactly. I try to describe the issue is that science is really a verb. It's not a noun. And that I think that there's a lot of confusion in terms of that. A lot of the stuff that, you know, we've talked about offline in terms of public health issues is science being treated as a noun, as fact. And what you alluded to and what I'm trying to suggest is that science is a process of inquiry, and it therefore will always change. There are some things that have been around for hundreds of years that we can consider immutable, but they still remain subject to change.
And therefore, every time we hear the word fixed science, we know that person doesn't know what they're talking about. Is that a fair statement?
Fair statement. On the other hand, just to argue the point, I think that there are times when there is a scientific consensus that may lend a little bit more certainty to that. But you're right. It's not fixed. There used to be a consensus that the sun revolved around the earth.
Yes.
And we've changed that consensus since then. But I would argue a little bit that when we have a consensus on things, when everybody seems to be pushing in that direction, that there's a little bit more certainty.
Yeah. And as long as you call it a consensus, not fixed, it makes sense. And we should pay attention to it.
Exactly.
You know, if I've got some kind of disease and you come up with a consensus of what's the bestest thing for it, I'm happy to have that as opposed to some other thing. I mean, yeah, that's valid. While we're talking about disease, and you've already mentioned this COVID, there's so much baloney that came out about COVID, and particularly in our military. People were thrown out of the military for not getting a shot that was not a scientifically proven anything. It was an experiment. There was so much confusion on that. Do you have, we can't take a year and talk about this, but can you give some kind of a wrap up on?
Yeah, I'm gonna take a slightly different position, because science is dynamic. So I think we have to start back when the pandemic began. And at that point in time, it was a novel disease that we knew very little about that was wiping away people in the nursing homes. So it appeared to be a far more serious disease than it ultimately turned out to be. But we got to go back to that early time to look at what was going on. There was the episode with the cruise ship where there was 20% of the people on board that were infected. there was the incidents with the Theodore Roosevelt, an aircraft carrier, where COVID took out 27% of the staff. So I think that there was a valid reason for the military to be concerned that this unique disease would hinder their operational ability.
I agree with you totally. You have to respond with what you got, but and you've got to keep moving, right?
Right. So at that point in time, when a vaccine became available, I think that it made good sense to think about vaccinating military personnel, just from an operational point of view. Now, and as I said before, I'm not a military guy, so I don't know a lot of the ins and outs in terms of how those orders percolate down, other than what I hear is that you have to follow the orders of your superiors or you have a problem. So I think that there's a lot of good sense in saying early in the pandemic, this is what we need to do. As the pandemic went along, it became clear that our concerns about how infectious this was and how severe this was not quite as it had appeared initially. It seemed to be a disease that was very severe in taking out the lives of the elderly and frail. It didn't take out the lives of the very young. So it was very different than influenza. And more specifically, when we looked at the military people, or that age group, people with comorbidities could become sick with it. Getting the vaccine reduced hospitalizations. It reduced, I think, to some degree, transmission, though we can argue back and forth about some of that. But then we began to see some data saying there's an incidence of myocarditis, especially in the young men in the ages 18 to 28, somewhere in that range. This is, you know, prime military group of people. And I think that at that point, it would have been worthwhile to say, let's take a pause and see where we should go from there. Now, I think that from my point of view, the data says in the end that getting vaccinated is a less risky approach to myocarditis than getting COVID. I think that the numbers suggest that getting COVID is more likely to result in myocarditis than getting the vaccine, though the numbers are very small and there's definitely some uncertainty in there. But if I was a public health guy and I was working in the military, then I might go with, out of an abundance of caution, I think we need to continue to vaccinate the troops. But I think that there's a valid conversation there that never took place.
And I agree with what you said. You've got to deal with what you know and what you have, but you've got to be continually looking. And I don't think we've yet had anybody in our government at any level say, oops, we made a mistake here.
I don't think we're going to be hearing that anytime soon. Now, I did go back and look, and I did find two fun facts about military inoculations, and I may be bringing coal to Newcastle here when I say that the first commander in chief who ordered the troops to be vaccinated was George Washington, and he had them all get virulated for smallpox because smallpox was killing more of the Continental Army than the British were. In fact, there's an argument to be made that if they had all been vaccinated, they would have won the Battle of Quebec, and Quebec would be part of the United States now. So I thought that was an interesting fact. He made that decision in, I believe, 1777, and all the troops were vaccinated. And what was even more interesting was that Jenner didn't come out and make the scientific case for vaccination until 1796. So George Washington was really dealing with the front edge of what we might call science, and I think made an operational call.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. Well, there's more to discuss about science, and Chuck is going to stay with us. This is Colonel Denny Gilliam on Frontlines of Freedom. It's time to do some deep knee bends. Hey, so just go halfway down each time. Do 40. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. We'll be right back. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code.
The Iraq War is more than 20 years old, and troops are still on the ground in Iraq. But why?
For too long, lawmakers have sent American troops to Iraq and beyond in support of vague missions that don't tie to a vital national interest.
At Concerned Veterans for America, we're translating our unique experiences as veterans to call for a better foreign policy that makes Americans safer and more prosperous.
Visit CVAfrontlines.com to learn more and join the movement. That's CVAfrontlines.com.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Chuck Dinnerstein from the American Council on Science and Health. Chuck, there's so much in the area of science, but how about climate change? That's an area where I think they're ignoring all the science. I've looked around. I'm in my 80s, and I haven't. Weather's been changing back and forth all my life. What's the science there?
Well, that's an interesting question. So weather and climate are different things, but we know that the climate changes. There's absolutely no reason not to strongly believe that's the case. At one time, North America was covered with ice. At one time, the Sahara was a verdant area full of all sorts of plant life. So we know the planet's climate, big picture, changes over time. I think that a lot of the fight at the moment comes down to how much of the current changes in the climate are due to humans versus the way the planet actually functions. And I don't know what the correct answer is. I'm going to put a little bit of uncertainty in. I'm going to say that I do believe that humans in burning fossil fuel has been responsible for some significant changes over the last 100-150 years. But there is going to be some uncertainty in that because we just do not understand how the climate works. And our models, which is what we use to make a lot of these decisions, are just not as sophisticated as we would like them to be.
That's a fair statement.
I'm a fair guy.
You know. There's nothing fixed about it. We know things are changing. But certainly in my lifetime, I remember when the North Pole was actually melting some. Nobody mentioned that the South Pole was growing in ice. I mean, nobody seems to be looking at everything. So we'll let that one go. We could beat
Well, it's very tough to, this gets to, I think, to another generalization you can make, is that we use a lot of computer modeling now to do for pandemics, for finding new drugs, and a variety of things. All models are wrong. All models are simplifications. And when you start to talking about climate, we've just begun to scratch the surface of what actually goes into the models. It wasn't until the last year or two that we had enough understanding that we could add the effect of clouds to our climate models.
Yeah.
That just shows you how far, clouds are around all the time. So if the models before that didn't have clouds in it, how accurate could they ultimately be? And I think that also gets to the thing that we started talking about previously, which is science, the verb, science, the noun. Science, the verb says we're working on a model and this is what we think is going on. The problem comes when science, the noun, jumps in and we decide we're going to cut back on this and you're going to cut back on that and so on and so forth. And that's a political, cultural, operational set of choices, which is not necessarily science-based. At best, we can hope sometimes that it's science-evidenced.
Yeah, okay. How about China? China is huge. We buy all kinds of stuff from them, including much of our medicines.
Yes.
And certainly that, I don't think there's any doubt that that's where COVID came from. Any thoughts on how we should be looking at China?
I'm going to say that none of this will reflect on the American Council of Science and Health, because I'm talking on my own at this point. But to my limited understanding of wars is that one of the reasons that we won World War II is that we could outproduce the Germans and the Japanese. that we could make more planes, we could make more ammunition, we could make more of everything. And that on the supply side, that made a difference in the fighting. And I think that in a lot of ways, that's what's currently under attack now from a variety of sources. We see our arms being depleted in two wars. So our production is moving towards Ukraine and Israel to supply them. We have problems with chips and offshoring all of these other things. So I think that China is a very smart country with a long memory about how things need to go and has already started trying to find ways to get at our weakness, which is to interfere with our economy in any of a number of ways. One of the ways would be the fact that they're building coal plants every week. While we are not, you know, we have cleaner air. We just have cleaner air. But since it's air is global, that air gets around the planet. You know, we've written a lot about fentanyl. I tend to think that fentanyl is payback for the opium wars with the British.
Good point.
You know, and we have any number of precursor drugs that are used in pharmaceutical manufacture that come from both China and India. And we have very little control over the quality of the materials being produced that then we use here. And, you know, depending on how you want to frame this, this may be one of the bad aspects of capitalism where the bottom line is the bottom line. We're not willing to pay a little extra to get a little bit more quality or to get a little bit more certainty of the purity of what we're working with.
You know, and from my perspective, I think it's time for our nation to start manufacturing those things again. But that's easy to say. If you came up with a bunch of money and said, hey, Den, start a factory to make medicine, I could build a factory, but I couldn't find anybody to work there.
Well, it's interesting when you think about the medicines. The one I remember the best, which is an early example, is when I was doing my medical school. I went to medical school in New Jersey, which is a big pharmaceutical state. And they were in the process of moving all the penicillin manufacture out, which they did. They moved all the penicillin manufacturing to Puerto Rico. And the reason was not so much economics. The reason was is that the penicillin was contaminating everything else. And to protect to protect people from pen allergies, they really had to get that manufacturer isolated into one particular plant. And so they offshored it into Puerto Rico, which is still part of the country.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's cool. Okay. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Chuck Dinnerstein. Chuck, we've only got a couple of minutes left. Take some time and talk about the American Council on Science and Health. I got a feeling it's probably a nonprofit and that you could use donations. How can people plug in? How can they learn more? How can they follow you? How can they donate?
We are on the web. It's at www.acsh.org. We have the usual website. We have a subscription, which is free, to our dispatch, which comes out 3 times a week, which highlights articles that we've been writing. And then we have a Saturday edition, which is a summary of the best of what we had written during the week. There are two other full-time writers on the website, Dr. Henry Miller, who used to be with the FDA, who is an expert in governmental regulation, among other things. And I think that would be an author that would resonate with your audience. The other full-time author is Dr. Josh Bloom, who is a chemist who writes extensively on chemistry as well as pain management and has been really in the forefront of talking about the fact that the overdose and fentanyl crisis that has overtaken us has very little to do with prescription opioid medications, but has a lot more to do with illicit use and the products coming in from Mexico and China. And he's been talking about this for like the last 10, 12 years.
That's so awesome.
I think there's a lot of things that people would find on the website of interest. I try to kind of cover some nutritional areas. We have Dr. Ballard, who is an ethicist and an attorney who writes on court issues that have come by so that you can get a better sense of some of these cases involving a Monsanto and Johnson & Johnson. We don't necessarily take one political side or another on any of these topics. So I think that your audience might find it an interesting
place. That's great. I encourage getting plugged in here. Chuck, thank you for sharing this really cool, important information today. And thank you for the way you're serving our nation. I appreciate you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You and your audience for having served.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with Vietnam vet Ron Corser. And of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our self-defense report. Troops, I hope you're giving serious thought to buying gold and silver to keep your future more secure. Check out Universal Coin. That's where I go, universalcoin.com/Denny. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm twice. Then take a break and stay in the area. I'll be right back.
HelpVet.net is here to help all veterans, active military, and families. HelpVet.net is a national help center helping the military community with their everyday needs. Whether you need a realtor, an attorney, discounted services, or information on retirement benefits, financial resources, and much more, our vast network of hand-picked qualified service providers are waiting to help you. With up-to-date military news and resources, you can find answers to all your needs at HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net, never forget, never forgotten.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country. Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, I really do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or comment on Facebook. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the show a fellow Vietnam vet and a friend, Ron Corser. Ron and I know each other from our volunteer work together at our church. So welcome, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Denny. And welcome to everybody listening to today's program.
Ron, tell us about your time in the Army. When and why did you join way back when we were younger?
Well, I joined because I got drafted, and I entered the United States Army on the 14th of June, 1968, and went through basic training at Fort Knox and AIT at Fort Polk, ended up as 11 Bravo. Ultimately, I ended up in Vietnam on March 28th, 1969. I was assigned to the 25th Infantry Division, 4th to the 23rd. It was a MEC unit. And that's where my adventure started in the United States Army.
So you went there basically right out of training, or were you in another unit in the States first?
Now, what happened is I got drafted, much to my chagrin, into NCO school.
Oh, that's right.
And I spent the whole time there. I did not want to go there. I just couldn't get out of it. So ultimately, when graduation came, what I did, for a lot of reasons here, we don't have to go into it, I declined my stripes, which enabled me to very quickly get orders to go to Vietnam. And that's how I ended up the end of March. The NCO school closed about this second week in March, and I very quickly spent my time flying over to Vietnam.
Okay. I understand that. And there are a lot of stories behind that NCO school, and we don't need to go into those right now. You and I were both infantrymen there, but you were mechanized infantry, right?
I was mechanized infantry, yeah. And a lot of times I tell people, the few times that people ask, because a lot of times people don't ask, that I think mechanized infantry had it a lot better than what I call the helicopter infantry guys, simply because we could never go out more than, say, two nights at the most, because we needed to always be refueled. So it wasn't like when I talked to guys, even you, Denny, where you may have spent 3 weeks, 4 weeks in a row out in the boonies. We always had to come back into a fire support base or TANN base camp to get fueled up again. And the other advantage I tell people is when we did go out and we were humping the boonies, we didn't have to carry, you know, 60 or 70 pounds of stuff, because we were never more than probably 10 clicks away, probably max from our tracks. So I just tell people we had a little easier, and I let it go at that.
Well, in my two tours, I think I maybe spent two times where I spent 20 minutes or so with a MEC unit. And I appreciated the fact that they always had water to drink, and I didn't have to carry my pack while I was working with them. But it was briefly, but I had been in a mech unit in the States before I went to Vietnam. So I knew a lot about it, but it didn't make any difference. And what I appreciated was you guys were there, but you were bigger targets than we were.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One time we had to pick up a crew from the 9th Infantry Division where we were stationed in Tainan Province. And he was basically straight-legged. And he was really nervous when we picked him up. And I said, his last name was Singletary. I said, what's wrong, man? He said, you guys are a great target for RPGs. And I laughed and I said, you know what? If that little guy can get a beat on us, because we got a 50 and 260s that we can point at him. I said, he's got cojones. I said, not many of them want to stand still under that kind of firepower, but he was not used to it. So I think in a lot of ways, you get used to certain things. One time I remember we weren't making enough contact to satisfy our battalion commander, and he took us and made us air mobile, which was, wow, I had never been in a helicopter before. And I thought to myself, good grief, I'm much more comfortable with a track than I am flying around in a helicopter with like an eighth of it, whatever the thickness of that was. So it's just what you got used to. I got very used to it, and I can't say much at all, but I was, in retrospect, I was much happier being a mech guy than I was being a straight-leg guy.
Well, I think your point's well taken, because my first tour, we were just straight-leg. We were just on the ground, occasionally in a helicopter, and occasionally worked with some mech guys, but that was a tiny percent of our time. My second tour, we were air mobile. And you get used to doing what you're doing, and you know what works and what doesn't work, and you're comfortable and safe doing it because you do know what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Human beings are interesting creatures, aren't we? We get used to anything once we're in it, and that becomes kind of normal to us. And anything outside of that becomes a little spooky. But that's just the way we are as human beings.
You know, there's a whole lot of truth in what you just said, bro. A whole lot of truth. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Vietnam vet Ron Corser. Ron, when it was over and you were coming home, did you have any problems coming home? Were you abused at all, or did you feel bad when you got home?
You know, that's an interesting question. When I came home, for some reason, I became aware that I had this sense that people thought, or I thought that I had done something wrong. And I don't know where that came from. I really don't. But it was, nobody really asked me about Vietnam. If they found out about it, they didn't want to ask about it. I had a couple people, when I went back for a college reunion that year, say some negative things because they had avoided the draft. But the sense that I had, I don't know where it came from, Denny, but I had a sense that for some reason I had done something wrong. And I lived with that for, oh gosh, a lot of years. And I was very angry about that. But, you know, when I got home, all I wanted to do was get a job. And at that point in time, you know, get married and get back to whatever normal life was. And I did that. Fortunately, you know, it wasn't a smooth transition, but it was a good transition. I just survived it and went on to have a reasonably good life, although there's some major bumps in the road in my life. But God has really poured out his spirit and upon his, you know, his graciousness upon me. So I got through all of that. And today I'm good with it. You know, I don't have resentments. I don't have anger like I used to have. A lot of that's because back in 2000, I finally got connected with my old company guys and some of the, in my own platoon and my own squad guys. And it come about in a very interesting way, but ultimately my being connected with them and ultimately opening up a little bit to some of the things that was going on inside of my head, I found out that I really wasn't crazy, because I thought I was for a long time, that I had normal thoughts just like everybody else. And interestingly, I still do today. My wife is always kind of surprised, but you know, when we go for walks in the woods, I still look for booby traps and I still think, wow, this would be a great place for a bush. I still go through that. I've come to believe, based on, you know, without talking to other guys, that that's normal. You know, I'm not crazy. It's just how you think. You get trained to do that. It's called survival, I guess. But I'm real comfortable with my life right now. And I'm very grateful to God that he's brought me this far.
I could not agree with you more. My experiences are different, but the same. Final question, what are you doing now?
Well, right now I'm involved, and I've been there for about 30 years in the financial services industry. We have a company called Cornerstone Retirement Partners. I'm a partner in that. We do income and retirement planning for people. God has really blessed us to be able to service and help folks. So that's where we are right now. I still continue to work. I enjoy mostly what I do. You know, I enjoy coming to work 4 out of 5 days a week. Every once in a while, I have a couple of fifth days, but that's pretty normal in life. But that's where we are right now. And my wife, Nancy, and our business, she does the healthcare part with Medicare and other Obamacare kinds of instances. So the firm that we have really is a full service retirement planning firm. We're starting to do tax planning too in a formal way. So life has been pretty good. God has really blessed us. And I'm real happy to be able to help people because I really believe that what we do makes sense.
Hey, sounds good. If listeners want to get in touch with you, how can they do it? Email or website or phone number?
We can go to the website. It's www.cornerstone, C-O-R-N-E-R-S-T-O-N-E, and then a dash, not an underscore, but a dash, R-P, RomeoPapa.com. That's our website. You can phone our office at 616-301-2581. Ask for me, answer any of your questions that you have, and help you in any way that you need help.
Ron, thank you. Thank you for sharing your experience in uniform and out of uniform and your service to our nation. God bless you, brother.
Well, God bless you too, Denny. We'll talk to you soon.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Next up, it's time for our weekly mailbag, then it's military history time. You reported for duty to front lines of freedom. Stand tall, troops. Let's do some more push-ups. How about 64 this time? I want your Ranger ready. Then stand at ease. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. When considering precious metal investments, credibility is paramount. That's why I choose Universal Coin and Bullion. They have a long-standing reputation in the industry that instills confidence in investors. Plus, the company president, Dr. Mike Fulgens, is recognized as America's gold expert by his peers and the U.S. government. Call 1-800-UCB-GOLD or go to their website at www.universalcoin.com/Denny.
Friends, Adam here, Patriot Foods, U.S. only company. Frozen fruits and vegetables straight from our dirt, not overseas. Support the U.S. farmer. When you shop at patriotfoods.com, we give back to a military family in need. We got to take care of each other, my friends. We have to. So important. 10% off patriotfoods.com, 10% off promo code FREEDOM, and shop today.
I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Frontlines of Freedom. I do a bit of coin collecting. Universal Coin was the dealer of the year for the American Numismatics Association. It's a great place to go for coins and a great place to go to purchase silver and gold. Go to universalcoin.com/Denny. That's universalcoin.com/Denny. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at Denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. Roland, what's the first one?
Well, Colonel, Navy Mom Sue Ellen, really liked both your Christmas and New Year shows. Very different, but full of real things to think about. Thanks.
Thank you, Sue Ellen. Our goal is to give our listeners things to think about and research to do on their own.
And then Pete, an Army vet who loves football, really enjoys your coverage of Service Academy football. He's unhappy that the season's over, and he'll have to wait until fall to enjoy it again.
Well, Pete, I'm glad you enjoyed Quentin's reviews. I do. All of our shows are posted on our website as podcasts. You can go there and listen again to the reviews of this past season. You might find that helpful. Okay, now it's time for military history. What's first, Roland?
On 10 January 1779, during our Revolutionary War, the French presented John Paul Jones with the dilapidated vessel, the Duc de Doris. Jones retrofitted the vessel, mounted it with 42 guns, and renamed it the Bonhom Richard in honor of Benjamin Franklin. On 19 June 1779, Bonhom Richard sailed from L'Orient. Forced to return to port for repair, the squadron sailed again 14 August 1779. Going northwest around the west coast of the British Isles and then down the east coast, they took 16 merchant vessels as prizes. On 23 September 1779, they encountered the Baltic fleet of 41 sails under convoy of the HMS Serapis and the Countess of Scarborough. Bonhomme Richard engaged Serapis, and a bitter engagement ensued during the next 4 hours before Serapis struck her colors. Bonhomme Richard suffered, shattered, and on fire and leaking badly, defied all efforts to save her and sank. John Paul Jones sailed the captured Serapis to Holland for repairs.
I'd say John Paul Jones did a good job there.
Agreed.
And on 8 January 1815, 2 weeks after the War of 1812 officially ended with the signing of the Treaty of Ghent, General Andrew Jackson achieved the greatest American victory of that war at the Battle of New Orleans. You see, in September of 1814, an impressive American naval victory on Lake Champlain forced the British forces back into Canada and to the peace negotiations in Belgium. Although the peace agreement was signed on December 24th, word didn't reach the British forces in time to halt a major attack. So the British marched against New Orleans, hoping to separate Louisiana from the rest of the U.S. Pirate Jean Lafitte, however, had warned the Americans of the attack, and the arriving British found the militiamen under General Andrew Jackson strongly entrenched at the Rodriguez Canal. In two separate assaults, the 7,500 British soldiers were unable to penetrate our defenses, and Jackson's 4,500 troops, many of them expert marksmen from Kentucky and Tennessee, decimated the British. In a half hour, the British had retreated, their general was dead, and nearly 2,000 of their men were killed, wounded, or missing. Our forces suffered only 8 killed and 13 wounded. Although the battle had no bearing on the outcome of the war, Jackson's overwhelming victory elevated national pride, which had suffered a number of setbacks. The Battle of New Orleans was also the last armed engagement between the U.S. and Britain.
It's amazing that Britain is one of our biggest allies today.
Hostilities had to end somewhere, and that's a good one.
On 10 January 1944, during World War II, the GI Bill of Rights, first proposed by the American Legion, was passed by Congress. The bill, more formally known as the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, was intended to smooth demobilization for America's almost 16 million servicemen and women. Post-war college and vocational school attendance soared as over 50% of honorably discharged veterans took advantage of education benefits of up to $500 a year for tuition plus a living allowance. When they returned home to marry and start families in record numbers, veterans faced a severe housing shortage. The home loan provision of the GI Bill provided over 2 million home loans and created a new American landscape in the suburbs. In 1990, President George Bush summed up the impact of the GI Bill by saying, quote, "The GI Bill changed the lives of millions by replacing old roadblocks with paths of opportunity."
Well, I agree. The house I'm living in now, I bought using the GI Bill.
So did I.
And on the 9th of January, 1945, during World War II, General Douglas MacArthur and our 6th Army landed in the Lingayen Gulf of Luzon, another step in the capture of the Philippine Islands. But in October 1944, over 100,000 American soldiers had landed on Leyte Island to launch one of the bloodiest battles of the Pacific War and heralding the beginning of the end for Japan. MacArthur waited ashore at Leyte on October 20th, returning to the Philippines as he has famously promised he would after the original defeat of American forces there. It took 67 days to subdue the island, with a loss of over 80,000 Japanese soldiers. Our forces lost about 3,500 men. The Sea Battle of Leyte Gulf was the same story. The loss of ships and sailors was horrendous for both sides. The Japanese lost their biggest and best warships, which meant the virtual end of the Japanese Imperial Fleet. These American victories opened the door for the landing of over 60,000 American troops on Luzon on January 9th. Once again, cameras recorded MacArthur walking ashore, this time greeted by cheering Filipinos. Although our troops met little opposition when they landed, our warships were in for a new surprise, kamikaze boats, which rammed the light cruiser Columbia and the battleship Mississippi, killing 49 Americans. The initial ease of our fighters' first week on land was explained when they discovered the intricate defense network of caves and tunnels that the Japanese created on Luzon. The goal was to draw our troops inland while allowing the Japanese to avoid the initial devastating bombardment of an invasion force. Once we reached inland, the Japanese fought vigorously. Despite their best efforts, the Japanese lost this battle and eventually the battle for control of all of the Philippines. And that's military history for today. And now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, Roland.
All of us here at Frontlines of Freedom believe strongly in your right to keep and bear arms for protection of yourself and your family. All across the country, violent crime is skyrocketing, and now more than ever, Americans need to stand up and exercise their Second Amendment rights. Now is the time to get trained and ready to handle this growing threat. But if you're not, please look into it and learn what you can do to legally carry a firearm to protect the ones you love. So, Colonel, what's the story this week?
Well, a sheriff's deputy was assaulted by a homeless man after the deputy had given the man a ride to try to help him out. The deputy was in the process of giving the man some money when the deputy was attacked. Fortunately, according to the Atlanta Constitution, a bystander stopped her car and shot the suspect, wounding him and saving the deputy sheriff's life. After his assault on the deputy, the wounded attacker ran to a nearby McDonald's and struck an elderly woman in the head, apparently attempting to steal her car. At that point, other people came to the elderly woman's aid and restrained the attacker. The deputy and the elderly woman were taken to the hospital to treat their wounds.
Thanks, Colonel. This is a great story, and things happen like this more often than you think. In fact, just do an internet search on armed citizen rescues police, and you'll find out what I mean. Oddly enough, many people ask the question, is it legal for a private citizen to use a gun to protect a police officer? The short answer is easy. Of course it is. Just be careful and use your best judgment. But before you try to be the hero, here are some things to keep in mind. First of all, practice safe gun handling. Make sure you keep your finger off the trigger until ready to shoot and that you don't point the gun at innocent people. It does no good to save a police officer and then accidentally shoot him because you couldn't handle your gun under stress. Number two, if the officer is capable, then once the bad guy is subdued, let the officer do his job. Talk to him. He'll already know that you're the good guy because you saved his life, but ask him what you can do to help further and follow the officer's instructions. Also, once the shooting is over, slowly and carefully holster your pistol. Most people shoot themselves accidentally when either drawing or replacing their gun. And finally, the officer you just saved knows you're the good guy. But when an officer in distress call goes out, dozens of law enforcement officers will arrive on the scene, and they'll probably won't know who you are. As soon as you are able, back away from the action and call 911. Tell them what happened, along with your name and a description of yourself. This legally armed woman did a great job and quite possibly saved the life of the deputy sheriff. Frontlines of Freedom salutes her bravery, her quick action, and her willingness to put herself in harm's way.
That's an amazing story, and one we all need to pay attention to. The movie of the month for this month is Cape May County. You can go to the Frontlines of Freedom website, go to the blog, and get the link. You can watch it for free. I'd appreciate getting your comments on the movie. Send your comments to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Frontlines of Freedom, Concerned Veterans for America will discuss some of our nation's challenges, and Andre Archie will discuss race issues in our nation and our military, and Gil and Skip will discuss the border and a book. Our book, Frontlines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. And it's now available in Spanish. You can purchase that book on frontlinesoffreedom.com or Amazon. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans. And do get active in correcting our nation. Plug into Concerned Veterans for America. Go to cvafreedom.com. That's cvafreedom.com.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Frontlines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. And please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, well, guess what? Our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the front lines of freedom. Stand tall, be proud Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information you will not get anywhere else on the front lines of freedom. Dismissed.